He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Hello and welcome to Country Life for this week. I nā iwi o te motu, tēnā koutou katoa. I'm Carol Stiles.
Kia ora, I'm Duncan Smith. Today we're hearing about some new kai for Kaipara. What will grow in its balmy clime?
I'm off to meet a Finnish winemaker. It's very difficult to make wine in a country that doesn't grow grapes, so New Zealand's her home for part of each year.
Later on in our feature, restoring a historic cottage in South Canterbury has become a labour of love for a retired couple. They didn't really know what they were getting into when they bought the old ruin. Sounds like most renovations.
But first to our look around the country. In Northland, around the Bay of Islands, the flooding and ponding of 2 weeks ago came and went quickly. A stock agent says the ground was so dry because of the drought, the water flowed over the top, and now soils are surprisingly dry for the time of year. This week has brought overcast days. Good cattle are selling well, but he says inferior crossbred cattle are very hard to market. They might be a Kiwi Cross dairy cow crossed with a beef breed. He says they don't grow like purebreds and people don't like looking at them in their paddocks. He says it's like having a beaten up car in your driveway compared with a shiny new one. The Pukekohe district has had fine weather and mild temperatures. Relatively dry ground conditions have allowed growers to get on with jobs and paddocks. Fields of bare ground are now changing to a light green as onions, early potatoes and vegetable transplants become visible above ground.
Things have never looked better on Waikato farms for the time of year. There's virtually no pugging, exceptionally high pasture covers and cows are in good condition, which could lead to a super flush in October. The flush of the season is the day when the most milk goes into the milk company's vat. There's been a very good recovery after the drought, even on badly hit Hauraki Plains farms. Some Waikato farms have 200 kilograms of dry matter per hectare, more than they would usually have at the end of July. Soil temperatures have remained elevated. They're sitting at a solid 13 degrees, which is great for grass growth. Many farms have had only 3 frosts. There's a bit of confidence about with decent prices forecast. Farmers are feeling people are laying off them a bit now they've realised farming is the backbone of the economy. In King Country, the pasture has a nice green tinge. There's a bit of fertiliser going on to give grass a final kick before lambing begins in earnest. Some ewes are a bit light. There's no excess of grass on the hills for cows.
The feed situation in Taranaki is almost embarrassingly good. A consultant says a good number of farmers are in a better situation at this point of winter than they have ever been in terms of feed and cow condition. Many farmers dried off early in April because of the dry. Then May brought magnificent growing conditions and June was good too. Rumour has it that one farmer made silage this week, which is unheard of for July. Cows have been calving in mild, fine conditions. Farmers are hoping their herds will calve quickly so they can take advantage of all the feed and they realise that things still have time to turn ugly. Across the island in the Gisborne region, it's been a beautiful sunny week with no rain. That's been great for farms getting into lambing because quite a few newborns were lost earlier this month when they arrived in torrential rain and cold weather. Dams have been filling following the drought. On the plains, kiwifruit developers are still on the lookout for suitable properties. They're land banking, so they're ready to go when they can get hold of a licence to grow gold kiwifruit. Developing a kiwifruit block doesn't come cheaply. The licence this year was about $400,000 per hectare. It costs an awful lot to set up water supplies and we're told to get all the other infrastructure in place and get kiwifruit in the ground, it would cost about $900,000 a hectare.
Down the road in Hawke's Bay has had heavy frosts this week, so the mornings have been a bit brisk, but the days beautiful. Unfortunately, frosts slow down grass growth. After farming through the drought, farmers are just squeaking through, seeking out the nearest blade of grass for their animals. A bit of nitrogen's going on, lambing's underway or is just about to start, and fortunately there have been no storms, snow or big rainfall events to put even more pressure on animals with little feed in front of them. Man, dog and beast have been enjoying mild and sunny conditions in Wairarapa. Stock are in great condition, grass is growing, and farmers are feeling pretty happy. It's been a kind winter. A farmer says Wairarapa's drought was shorter than Hawke's Bay's but still stung. He says it's been calculated that by the end of March, a farmer with 5,000 sheep would have needed to buy in the equivalent of 700 tonnes of barley to keep animals fully fed. Manawatū has had an absolute dream of a week with frosts and gorgeous days, perfect for calving and early lambing. Grass is growing really well. It's still very dry, though, and hill country dams are empty, which is a real concern.
Across Cook Strait and a Nelson hop grower says the garden has been tidied up, ready for the 2021 crop. NZ Hops has just released a new variety called Nectaron. Its release had been delayed because of COVID-19, so was rescheduled to fit in with its AGM. Plenty of growers went to the meeting and they heard the Governor of the Reserve Bank, Adrian Orr, give what our contact says was an impressive view on things financial. A farmer in the Marlborough Sounds has all his livestock set stocked for lambing and calving. He sold over 1,000 store lambs at very reasonable prices. They've gone to make sure there's good feed left for replacement ewe lambs to grow out. A small line of cull ewes has been sent to the works and they made $4.80 per kilogram. The weather has cooled with some very fresh southerly winds and it's unusually dry for the time of year. The farmer's getting ready for native tree planting in another 3 weeks. It's the beginning of a large project to run over the next 4 years or more. Meanwhile, a local mussel farmer is waiting for the remaining lines of mature crops to be harvested. It's been quite a long wait. The export market is slow because of COVID-19, but the domestic market is very reliable.
Luckily, the West Coast didn't get the predicted 400 millimetres of rain. Cows are starting to calve, and that's quite early. Our farmer contact says it could be because short gestation bulls have been used. The vets are noticing the early start to the season with calls from farmers. Meanwhile, our farmer says he doesn't have much grass because he had to hold on to beef stock during COVID, when the works couldn't take them. And a sales deal with cows he thought was sorted has fallen through because the purchaser didn't have enough feed. But on the plus side, cows are in good condition, having been well fed with winter crops. It was a good week of dry weather in Canterbury, with mostly above normal temperatures. This is driving early grass growth and is pleasing for dairy farmers who are starting calving. Grazing block farmers are making the most of the dry ground conditions and getting on and planting early spring cereals. It also warmed up in the Mackenzie Basin this week. A farmer says the temperature hit 10 degrees for the first time in a long time. He's hoping the full brunt of winter is over now, but he won't speak too soon. The grass is very slowly coming back to life, so there's a bit of weed spraying happening.
There are already quite a few calves around in South Otago. Again, as on the West Coast, they're a week to 10 days early, although in this case, farmers don't exactly know why. It's just the season. And here it's warmed up too. Temperatures hit 14 degrees this week, which was welcome. And ditto for Southland, much warmer than normal, spring-like even. Some places had a bit of rain, and on the whole, the district is looking good. Very early calves and lambs are appearing.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Northland's Kaipara district stretches from coast to coast and curves around the upper Kaipara Harbour. It's home to 24,000 people. The landscape is diverse and includes, sometimes soggy flats, hundreds of kilometres of coastline, rolling hills and steep sides. At the moment, the region's biggest crop by far is kumara, but there's also cereal crops for grain, pumpkin, squash and courgettes, as well as some tomatoes and cucumbers grown in glasshouses. But that list is set to expand. Ruawai is now home to the Kaipara Kai Hub, funded by the Provincial Growth Fund and opened in March. The hub's manager, Matt Punter, says the goal is to promote food production so the region can become more economically resilient.
With the pressures on Pukekohe, we kind of see an opportunity in the area to take up some of that slack. And some of the research that we've done in that space suggests that we've got about 50,000 hectares of underutilised land. And that could have a significant impact on our local economy if we used it.
What sort of quality is the soil around here?
It's variable, as with most places, but through some of the research that's been done by Land Care and Manaaki Whenua, they think that the land is suitable for a raft of different horticultural activities.
So what could we see growing here?
The likes of peanuts and soybeans, a raft of arable crops for grain like sorghum. But as we look further forward, it is not impossible to sort of identify the likes of pineapples, bananas, and various other subtropical fruits that historically we may not have thought about growing in New Zealand.
Oh, if we start with peanuts, are any peanuts grown in New Zealand?
Peanuts have been grown in New Zealand in the past, but not as a commercial crop.
What conditions do they need?
They're needing quite loose or poor quality soil, actually, which suits a lot of our coastal areas. But they do require very, very high soil temperatures to germinate. So again, that's why there is a focus when we look at those activities on areas that can provide soil temperatures in excess of sort of 18 degrees.
Wow, that's quite high.
It is very high. It's very high. And so, yeah, your production is very much limited on that aspect.
You mentioned sorghum.
So, yeah, sorghum was one that was identified. Our research partners in that space identified sorghum. It's the fifth largest grain crop grown in the world. We currently don't grow sorghum in New Zealand, or very little sorghum in New Zealand for grain. And so there is a market opportunity. But it also offers us a point of difference, because it is what we would see as a resilient cultivar to climate. And so by that, what I mean is that it tolerates low water conditions, and so therefore the need for irrigation and for large-scale irrigation for that crop becomes less. So I guess with sorghum, what we're looking at there is that not only is it something that potentially we could grow now, but as we look further afield, it may be a crop that we can grow successfully as the climate, or if the climate should change.
Do you have many people walk through the door and ask you about what they could possibly grow?
We've had over 300 inquiries. We've had guys that are existing horticulturalists that are looking for new opportunities. We've had guys that own land, which they've historically leased, but are now feeling like they'd like to do something with their own land. We get everything from lifestyle blocks, where there might be 2 to 5 acres, up to guys that own 3,000 plus acres, all sort of asking and trying to identify opportunities for themselves. We've had not only landowners, but small businesses associated with food production, community groups and wanting to understand more about what they could potentially go, school groups. So, the interest in terms of what we can grow and what we can be doing is extremely high.
What's the first thing that you think might be planted around here that is different from what's planted now?
So, we've tried some existing crops already, Carol. And so, some of the existing crops, the likes of red onions and beetroot, what we've done there is that we've actually looked at the climate of the Kaipara, and we've said, what can we grow out of season? And so we've actually got those products in the ground now, and they'll be ready for harvest in August and September time. So looking at traditional crops, but how you can utilise the climate and the soil types to allow us to grow them at different times of the year, that's an important part of our role here as well. This summer, once the soil temperatures get up, we will definitely see some peanuts in the ground in a trial context. And so we'll be looking at whether or not, and understanding whether or not it's sustainable or feasible to be actually able to grow those crops in the district.
Where's the warmest place in the Kaipara?
The warmest place in the Kaipara is on the Pauto Peninsula, and some of the little nooks and crannies over there. It doesn't have frosts, or very light frosts at best. But yeah, for us, the soil temperature and the soil type along that peninsula, that's where it would be most favourable for us to be growing peanuts.
So if I came in and said, hey, I live 100 k's from here, got 25 hectares, think of growing a horticulture crop, What would you suggest I do? Would you want me to get a soil test? What would be the first step?
The Kaipara District Council and the Kaipara Kai Initiative, they've done a bit of the groundwork. So they've obviously done a topo climate study, and so we can get an indicative idea of what your area looks like. But yeah, like with all things, once we've had the discussion, we can then set a plan in place. And so you would do a soil test. You would need to know whether you've got water or access to water, because it's pretty hard to grow things if we don't have water. And then it's really understanding what you're looking at achieving. So for some people, it is not about money. It's about sustainability and the environment. And so how we structure something around that operation is a lot different to potentially someone that's looking to employ a large number of people and develop an export crop.
What would you like to see happen here in the community in 10 years' time as a result of some of these new crops going in?
With any of the opportunities that we have in terms of growing on the land, you know, that brings associated employment opportunities through pack houses and transport and logistics, which can only be really great for the community.
Matt Punter from Kaipara Kai in Ruawai. Kaipara Kai is part of the bigger $28 million Kaipara Kickstart program designed to improve community well-being and economic growth in the district. The program is looking at water storage and at upgrading bridges and wharves and sealing and improving roads to make it easier to get food to market and to connect communities.
For our next story on Country Life, I'm heading to Hawke's Bay's wine country.
It's a fake name from my takeaway coffees. I've got so tired of spelling my name to people millions of times. They're like, coffee for who? And then now I just use Sandy. Because somebody once got it wrong and they heard OT, they heard Sandy instead of OT. So now I just use Sandy. So if you hear a takeaway coffee for Sandy, that's me usually.
This is in fact OT Jakavieta.
Yeah. I'm just connecting some hoses. I'm going to wash some barrels today. I pulled some wine out of barrel yesterday and now I have to wash them and steam them and put them away for the next wine.
Oti is a rare breed. She's a Finnish winemaker.
So I came here in 2004 to do 1 year at Lincoln University, the postgraduate diploma in wine science and viticulture. And after that, I did a harvest in Marlborough Vineyards in Marlborough. So I've been doing New Zealand Europe for ever since that. So, so it's like, yeah, basically 6 months here and 6 months in Europe.
Are there many Finnish winemakers?
I think there's a handful of us, maybe under 10. I think somebody who does exactly what I do, as in just work for other people and consulting, probably none. It could be just me.
It's not a big grape-growing nation, is it?
No. Technically, we are not even allowed to make wine in Finland. It's like inside the European Union, you have to register as a wine country, and Finland is not. So there's a lot of distilling and beer making in Finland, but no grapes. So I'm thinking the growing season might be a little bit too short for grapes in Finland. As a country who does not produce any of their own wine, the Finns will drink wines from all over the world. They have very open mind, whether it's from Germany or New Zealand or the USA. Because I think New Zealanders obviously would like to drink local, but Scandinavia in general is a very, very good market. Also, people are used to the fact that alcohol is quite expensive, so they are willing to pay for their wine.
When I was looking up Finnish wine, yeah. It was a very short search.
But I did, well, yes.
Yeah, but I did find that there's a lot of spirits made.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we have lots of forest in Finland and lots of berries. So that's kind of a good ingredient of making all sorts of liqueurs and putting blueberries into your gin and all sorts of innovative other drinks. Yeah. We have this thing called every man's right, where you are allowed to go and pick berries in anybody's forest. Yeah, it's, I don't know how to explain it otherwise, but let's say if you own a lot of forest, you know, I can just go there and pick berries in your forest.
What made you want to work in the wine industry? Because it wouldn't have been something you were exposed to when you were younger.
No, I quite accidentally ended up picking some grapes in France, and then one thing led to another. I sort of just discovered this was something I wanted to do. And then one year I was back in France, and I met this guy from Australia who offered me a job in Australia. That's how sort of I ended up in New Zealand, because while I was there, well, I had to come here also, so yeah.
So you're working here, but you're also making your own wine that you send back home.
Yeah, yeah. So that started in 2013. I had this Finnish friend working with me in Martinborough, and we just had a little bit too much wine and a crazy idea that let's make some of our own wine and import it to Finland. And that's sort of how it started. And it's only a tiny little production. The company is called Three Barrel Project, so basically we make three barrels of everything, and then I'll just ship it to Finland, and usually I go back to Finland for summer too, and then I try to sell it there, but this year, because of the current situation in the world, I'm a little bit stuck in New Zealand, which is okay. It's been mainly Pinot Noir, but I'm hoping for maybe in the future I can make something out of Hawke's Bay too. Maybe a bigger red or a Chardonnay, maybe.
You've made wine in New Zealand that you've taken back home, but you've also made it elsewhere in the world,
haven't
you?
Yes, so also then expanded a little bit and made wine in Europe. So I've made a bit of wine in Catalonia in Spain. And last year I was in Switzerland, of all the places, and hopefully there will be something coming out of that too. So I was meant to go and check out how is it all happening there, but that's also been postponed a little bit.
Do you really only make three barrels, or do you make a bit more?
Yeah, it's pretty much only three barrels of each wine.
So how many bottles might you get out of that?
So you get about 300 bottles out of one barrel, so 900.
Is there a bit of excitement in Finland about this wine produced by a Finnish winemaker that's coming back home?
Yeah, it's a bit of a sort of a sales point. I guess you can also sell your wine better when you can stand behind your product saying that, oh, I made this, you know what happened there. So
how much do you sell one bottle of wine for in Finland?
So the most expensive Pinot, my sort of flagship Pinot, it retails about 30 euros. What would that be in dollars?
50, mate.
Yeah, 50, yeah. I think it's a pretty ongoing price for New Zealand Pinot, even here, if you're making it.
So it's not astronomical?
No, but I guess then when you do sell it to a restaurant and then they put their markup on top of that, then maybe it becomes quite expensive. I'll show you some of my wine labels, but we just have to go to my office, aka my wine cellar. So I've been really lucky. My sister's partner is a graphic designer, so he's done a lot of work for me. And also I've got friends who've actually donated me artwork for my labels. And I've used New Zealand label printers because they seem to... I mean, there's companies in New Zealand that are specialised in making wine labels, as in Finland, not so much.
You're the one who has to check all the spelling.
Yeah, that's me.
Oh,
yes. Okay, so there's one. So this is called Alisa, which is Alice. It's named after my grandmother, who just passed away last year at the age of 106. I know. Yeah. And so it's got like a cross-stitching kind of a label that I inherited, this like a cross-stitching book from her. And then my brother-in-law sort of turned it into a label.
Gosh, the things your grandmother lived through.
Yeah, she died just before Christmas at the age of 106. And my mom said to me, oh, I'm glad grandma didn't have to see COVID-19. So, yeah, I guess that's the silver lining there. Yeah. So that's a Mambrè Pinot that was 100% whole bunch in a tank, fermented in a tank with, like, whole bunches.
So all of the stems as well?
Yeah, yeah, all the stems. And it was fermented for 2 weeks in a tank and then got pressed into the 3 barrels and stayed in the barrel for 10 months and bottled.
So, are you pleased with it?
Yeah, I am, yeah. Yeah, it's just arrived in Finland last week, so now I have to try to do some remote selling, as in from New Zealand winter to the Finnish summer. So writing emails to people, can you please try my wine? I don't own any vineyards, obviously, so I just buy grapes. I think in New Zealand it's really, really easy to find some good quality grapes. So it just comes down to the knowing the right people and the right growers.
Does it make you any money or is it just a hobby?
Yes, good question. It makes me enough to carry on to doing this lifestyle of travelling back and forth.
When you do your 3 barrels, yeah, you're producing about 900 bottles.
Yeah, that's about it. It's tiny, I know. Yeah.
You've been winemaking all around the world.
Yeah.
Does it change very much from country to country, or is it pretty much the same wherever you go?
I guess theory is, you know, how to make wine, it's quite similar. It's just there's cultural differences, and obviously vineyards are different from country to country. Europe obviously has way more traditions about winemaking than New Zealand, but then what I do like about New Zealand is that you can experiment and do all sorts of crazy things, and people are quite open-minded of doing that. Mm. Sometimes in Europe, you got an idea and they tell you, oh, no, you can't do it. it's against the laws or something. Yeah. Whereas here, you know, you tell it to your boss and he's like, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's do it.
What might that be? What sort of thing might you suggest?
Yeah, you might try a different grape variety with the same technique or blending together grape varieties that are normally not blended together. Or like making sparkling wine out of Sauvignon Blanc. I don't know, that seems a bit crazy to me, but hey, the Kiwis did it.
What part of Finland are you from?
I'm from Helsinki, so born and bred city girl. So this is as country as I've ever done. New Zealand. It was a bit of a shock in the beginning, but now I'm kind of used to it and I quite like living out in the countryside. It was just so different when you grow up in big city and, you know, everything functions and there's lots of people, and then you come here and it's like, oh, well, internet's down. But I lost electricity for a few hours, you know. I have to wake up every morning for my neighbor's rooster, and which is kind of okay. But yeah. And it's like, ah, okay. And it's quiet and it's nice. My problem every year is when I go back to Finland and I'm all like, yeah, this year I'm going to stay. Then I start missing all my people in New Zealand and New Zealand in general. And then I just get really edgy and I come back. And then I'm like, ah, oh, so good to be back.
Outi Jaakavirta ending that story. She says high taxes on alcohol contribute to its price. Alcohol is 72% more expensive in Finland than in the European Union on average. And here's another Finnish fact I found. Finland has the highest per capita consumption of coffee in the world, an impressive 12 kilograms per person each year.
Hi, I'm Dave Barton of Remarkable Valet, the cutest sheep in the world. You are listening to Country Life, RNZ National.
Now we're in South Canterbury with Cosmo Kentish Barnes to meet Jane Batchelor, a retired GP with a passion for history. And we're meeting her husband, Graham. They're on a mission to preserve and restore a couple of historic farm worker cottages.
We're in the Birkshaus Valley, and the valley really starts at the Dobson ski field bridge over the Opahi, and runs parallel to the Two Thumbs Range, which we can see over here on our right, and it's got a scattering of snow on top of it, which always makes it look lovely. We've got hills again over on the left, and we can see Dog Trial Hill, and there's remains of yards and an old shed that are busy tumbling down the hill. You can hear in the background probably water running, so that's our water supply, which comes from Paddy's Market Creek, a natural watercourse that was partly diverted under the highway, under our garden, and then comes out into that fluming and over the water wheel at the bottom there, which is fantastically covered in icicles at the moment.
Now, Jane, tell me about the property here, because we are standing in front of a Cobb cottage.
Yes, that's right. This was built by James and Bridget Keefe, who arrived in New Zealand in late 1876. And I think they came out as assisted immigrants, and James worked as a shepherd on the Rollesby Station. And Rollesby Station was a very big deal in the Bourke's Pass and Mackenzie area. It was one of the first big land holdings that was taken up here after European arrival. And so Rollesby Homestead was a little cob building. And from the pictures I've seen, because it no longer exists, it looks likely that it followed exactly the same form as the original part of this cottage. So I'm suspecting that James took Rollesby Homestead as a blueprint and built this cottage. And while they did so, they lived over the road in a, I suspect, very primitive house there, because they called it the mansion.
The bachelors purchased the rundown cottage and some adjoining farmland back in 1984.
We were very lucky that we caught this cottage at a time when the exterior cladding was dissolving in front of our eyes, and the windows, where they were not under a veranda, were also dissolving. And we decided that when this particular wall that we're looking at the moment, it was completely rotten and gone, we decided that we would recreate that in cob. And cob is one of those materials that the early European settlers used where there was not much timber. So cob being a mixture of clay, animal manure and chopped snow tussock. And I suspect that this lower terrace here that we've got behind us with the orchard in it, that was where the clay was dug. And the tons of clay that must have gone into making this cottage would be phenomenal. But it's a pretty amazing material and very cheap, and I'll show you an old cob ruin in a moment that has survived for a very long time with no attention, and it's still there.
Did you do the building, or did you find someone who knew how to do this kind of work?
Well, we knew nothing about cob, probably even barely heard of it really, though the lovely appearance of it, the way it's sort of tussock coloured and it blends into the hills and the surroundings, we just really enjoyed. But we made a contact through the Historic Places Trust. They put us onto him, David Studham, who was a very kindly, genial farmer from Te Waimate. He had done a number of repair and salvage works on cob buildings around the South Island, and he took us under his wing and gave us some ideas as to what we could do.
It sounds like it was quite dilapidated. Inside, was there any furniture or relics from the past?
Well, the interior was surprisingly intact, which was fantastic. So there's a number of rooms that are of match lining, which is also known as tongue and groove, There were relics of the old wallpaper there. There was the old lino, which I just think is gorgeous, lovely old patterns that you can't buy these days. And I guess another really good thing was that the previous owner, Hedley Green, he was a bachelor, not a bachelor by name as we are, but he wasn't terribly interested in housekeeping and houses and so on. He just wanted to keep warm and have a shelter over his head. So he didn't spend money on altering the place. It was just largely as his parents bought it in the early 1900s. And so we were very grateful for that, that he wasn't interested in upgrading and making it all smart. And
and in fact, you were saying before that there's still a long drop here.
Yes, yes. So we still have an authentic colonial experience, I call it. And most people are flabbergasted when we say that we've still got a long drop here, but it does require a walk down the garden path and through a couple of picket gates to get to, but it functions very well. However, in our old age, we have come to the conclusion that an inside flush toilet might be quite nice.
Graham, what have you done on the land since you've been here?
Fixed fences. Made gates, put gates on so we could sort of run a few stock on it. Lots of shelter belts, which are native shelter belts down around the place, you can see. That's what I labour away at most of the time when I'm not getting conned into working on cob buildings.
Are those your sheep in the paddock that we can see?
Yeah, those ones there are, yeah. I've got about 35 breeding ewes. It's pretty small. I don't know how anyone makes a profit out of a small mob, but yeah, it's an interest. But one of the major things was we plant a lot of pine as an earth crop for growing natives underneath and oak trees underneath, and the native area is one of Jane's things really, and she's planted thousands of native plants right down through there, right down to the river.
Where do you source your seeds from?
Well, when we first bought this property, obviously one of the attractions was the historic cottage, but one of my other big passions in life is native bush. And while I liked the property for every other characteristic it had no major native bush close. And I think that's a characteristic of the Mackenzie until you're way over at Mount Cook. It's a relatively treeless landscape, which has its own beauty. However, I was aware that there were remnants up some of the gullies, usually on private land, nothing much that was publicly accessible. And so I thought, well, if we haven't got native bush, I'll jolly well plant some. So we've found a gully up in Firewood Creek where we had the owner's permission to go and gather seed and take cuttings from some of the plants there. And so I've always kept my eyes peeled.
Oh, thank you. We are walking through one of your paddocks in the direction of your sheep, and this is where there's another cob cottage.
This is Anna's cottage, and you'll see how it's just sort of perched on the edge of this bank. So luckily it's a very well-drained site and means that it's survived pretty well. And it's hard to believe now, but this cottage, which was probably built in about the same time as our place in the late 1870s, 1880s by John and Margaret Annis. They had a family of, I think, about eight children lived here. And one of those daughters, I think, she won the ballot for Curramore Station. So this was an era where some of the very large landholdings were being broken up by the government to enable more farmers to settle on the land. And so there were a number of stations that had huge landholdings taken over, divided up and put in a ballot which people could enter. And I understand that you could enter every man, woman and child into this ballot. I don't know about the cat, but anyway, I think one of the young daughters won the ballot for Curramore Station. And so this family, who had done a variety of jobs when they lived here, moved to Curramore, and because materials were scarce and expensive, they removed everything that they could from this cottage, including the iron roof. So this move was in 1911, and the roof was removed, all the iron taken to Curramore, and I understand is over one of their shearers' quarters still at Curramore. So the cob walls were left and floors, wooden floors, left completely unprotected to the elements. So it was really hard almost to see that there was a cottage here before we started working on it. It had been used as a pig enclosure, and it had had a whole lot of wilding elderberry trees. You can see there's elderberry trees along this bank here. And they'd seeded themselves in there, and inside the cottage itself there were probably five or six mature trees, and the walls were largely eroded. But we always thought that one of the things that is unique to Bourke's Pass Valley, or not completely unique in New Zealand, but to this part of the world, is the number of cob cottages and cob buildings. And we thought, look, this one is on its last legs, but could be revived. Why not? Let's do it. So we contacted the owner. He was a mining engineer in Australia, and he was happy to let us start doing some restoration work and protection work on it. Thankfully, since we've been able to purchase it from him, and we've built the walls up to meet the roof now, so they're holding the weight of the roof.
Now we're looking inside the cob cottage, and you've done some very handy cob brickwork.
So to make a piece of wall quickly, we made these big cob blocks. That wasn't how it was built originally. We think it was built up in layers. The word cob refers to a great big sort of round or oval-shaped loaf of bread. And when you make the cob mixture, you make a big lump of it and you place these lumps forcefully together. And then when you've built up a wall, you take a sharp implement and cut it to make the walls straight. I'll just take you through here, which is, so there was a kitchen area with that big cob chimney, and just behind this communicating door there's a large slab of cob that was actually not upright when we came. There were also big holes in the base of the walls and places where animals had, they seemed to love to lick the cob to get the salts from the earth.
Now, Jane, recently you co-authored a book that tells the stories of people who were buried in the Burke's Pass Cemetery.
Yes, that's right. This book was started about 10 years ago by a friend, and I came on board and helped bring this to fruition about a year ago. The Burke's Pass Cemetery was the first cemetery in the Mackenzie area and got a lot of interesting stories and tales to tell, and reflects the sort of hardships and life that people led in the early days, and obviously is still a working cemetery, but this booklet probably focuses more on the earlier generations buried there.
We've come to the cemetery, which is about a kilometre from your cottage. Yes. And there's a bit of snow here.
Yes, they've had a bit of snowfall here over the last week or so, and it's still sitting there on the ground in the shady areas. Yeah.
If it wasn't for the oak trees that surround the cemetery, very old oak trees and the conifers, it would be very exposed here, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be a cold, cold place. Our first grave inside the gateway is John and Georgina Burgess, and they kept the hotel and donated the land that the little St. Patrick's Church was built on.
You must have found out about some interesting stories when you were doing the research.
My co-author, Liz Angelo-Roxburgh, who started the project, she was the inspiration, really. So she used to wander around up here, it's a lovely spot, and saw the stories on some of the gravestones and thought we should really record some of this for posterity and also relatives who are wanting to research their loved ones. So she made a small selection and we published those in that little booklet that's now available.
Who was the first person to be buried in the cemetery?
So the cemetery was first established in 1873, and the first burial was actually of a little boy who was only about 8 or 9 days old. So he's buried over here in the corner, and the stone is getting quite weathered now, but as we crunch our way through the snow to see his headstone.
Frank James Cowan.
So here's young Frank. So beside Frank, I mean, there's a lot of very heart-rending graves here. Next door to Frank is a sister, Christy Cowan, who died aged 4 years. And I think that was an accidental death. A huge number of the gravestones in the cemetery are from accidental deaths, either being kicked by a horse or drowned in a river or mountaineering accidents. But there were a lot of physical hardships in those early days and a lot of dangerous situations that people entered into, whether it was snow, cold, rivers. One of the gravestones in the next corner of the cemetery was of a young man who died in an avalanche, and he was actually the son of the landowner that donated the land for this cemetery, John Smith. And he died with accompanied by a shepherd, Duncan Morrison, who was in his 40s. They died in an avalanche off the Rollsby Range, which was one of the very first avalanches in New Zealand recorded. causing death. I think the first was probably in central Otago somewhere, but...
Were they moving stock?
I suspect they were moving stock, and this massive avalanche came along. I think a dog may have returned and the men didn't. And it took about 6 weeks for search parties to actually find where the bodies lay. Very sad.
Jane Batchelor ending that story. Cosmo was also talking to her husband, Graham. If you'd like to get a copy of the book Jane's co-written about the cemetery, go to the Burke's Pass Heritage Trust page on Facebook. And you can also see a gallery of photos from the day on our webpage.
And that's Country Life for another week. If you'd like to hear what's coming up on the program, you can go to the Country Life page and sign up for our newsletter. Until next week, have a great weekend.
Bye now.